I call this meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order on Tuesday, April 14th. We do have a quorum. First order of business is we have some minutes from April 9th, 2026. Chair Akam, would you like to move the minutes?
I would like to move the minutes. So moved.
Any discussion? We have motion for minutes. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Motion fails. The minutes are adopted. First bill, Chair Akam, you want to move your bill?
Thank you. Yes, I would like to move House file, which one are we on? 4560, to be laid over.
Great. House file 4560 is laid over. The motion is to lay it over. Chair Akam, tell us about your bill.
Great. So this is really a Public Utilities Commission technical fixes bill. And what it's really focusing on is eliminating some old language, updating statutes, and removing references to expired dates and statutes that are no longer in use. And we're lucky enough to have Executive Secretary Mike Bull with us today to tell us a little bit more in detail about what it does. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bull. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Bull. I'm the Deputy Executive Secretary of the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. And thank you guys for taking the time in a very busy hearing to hear this, our technical cleanup bill, House File 4560. And thank you to Chair Akam for being our chief author. This legislation is our effort to update and streamline Minnesota statutes governing the work of the Public Utilities Commission. Primary goal, as Chair Akam mentioned, is to ensure that our regulatory framework remains clear, modern, free of obsolete language that no longer serves the interests of the state. So House File 4560 focuses on a few main areas of improvement, such as eliminating archaic language, updating our statutes to reflect current practices, removing references to expired dates, repealing statutes that are no longer in use. House File 4560 is our definition, and I think everyone's definition of a housekeeping measure, by repealing outdated statutes and clarifying language used across specific chapters of Minnesota statutes that govern the work of the commission. This bill improves the ability of the commission to implement these statutes with clarity and efficiency, and I respectfully ask your support in moving it forward this year. Happy to answer any questions.
Great. Anyone else from the public that wishes to testify? Seeing none, we'll move to member questions and discussions. Chair Stutzinski.
And this would be just a question to Mr. Bull. Like, when is the last time that this committee has received a report on the Telegraph Commission? I don't remember seeing that. I was looking through the paperwork, and I'm a little upset. So.
Feeling gypped.
Does anyone else have any questions? Unless you'd like to respond, Mr. Bull.
I could look it up, but I...
Okay. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I was just curious why you extended the time from 30 days to 60 for
Mr.
the complaint
Bull.
Process.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the 30 days tend to be too tight for parties to get their work done, and so we wanted to make sure we were not constraining the public and, process so that we ensure that everybody has an opportunity and then the commission has its chance to make decisions.
Representative Murphy?
Chair, how long has that been in effect, the 30-year window?
That 30 days. It has been in place for quite a number of years. That was one of the things we've been carrying as we've been thinking, a lot of this in this bill. We've been carrying these provisions along, trying to figure out when's the right time to bring this technical bill forward. We figured this year would be as good as any. So I could look up specifically when that 30-day went into statute and how long it's been there, but we think it'd be
Thank
helpful.
You, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Anything else? Closing comments? Chair Akam?
Please support the bill.
Okay, with that, House File 4560 is laid over.
Thank you.
Next, Chair Akam, House File 4559. Move your bill.
Yes. I'd like to move 4559 be laid over, and there is an A2 amendment.
Okay, you want to move the A2?
Is it the A2 or the A1?
I think it's the A2.
Two. It's the A2.
Let's pop out and grab it. Yeah. It's the A2. So let's see. Chair Aiken moves the A2. Any discussion on the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The A2 is adopted. Chair Aiken, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am, my apologies, with all of these bills and papers, I seem to have misplaced my info or my introduction. So I am going to just, we will wing it. Thanks, we can look at that. House File 4552 as amended is, again, just really a technical cleanup bill that changes some reporting dates, that streamlines some processes and allows the development of some programs that have already been passed but not been implemented. And while that is a short and succinct introduction, I'm going to pass it over to our assistant commissioner.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Polish. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed?
Thank you, Chair and members. My name is Lissa Polish. I serve as the Assistant Commissioner of Federal and State Initiatives for the Minnesota Department of Commerce in the Division of Energy Resources. Thank you all for your consideration of and the opportunity to testify on House File 4559, the Commerce Department's Energy Bill. As Representative Aikum indicated, this is largely technical in nature, but it does include some important updates that will help us operate our programs more effectively. Sections 1 and 2 focus on providing Commerce with the authority to develop and maintain a statewide energy security plan. This is consistent with historic federal requirements that have since lapsed, and we want to make sure that we still have the authority to do that energy preparedness planning. Sections 3, 4, and 5 extend timelines to allow applicants for existing programs, including the electric school bus program and the solar on public buildings program, a bit more time to advance their projects. Sections 6 and 7 make updates to the Minnesota State Competitiveness Fund program, particularly around the match fund implementation, and then align the financial reporting with the state fiscal year to make sure it's on that clean cycle. And finally, Section 8 makes changes to align the state heat pump program with the requirements of the federal program so we can facilitate the stacking of incentives and rebates when those federal programs become available. But it also updates the eligibility requirements so that while the federal programs remain in limbo, we would be able to start implementing that program immediately. With that, thank you, Chair Aikum, for sponsoring the bill, and thanks for the committee's consideration. I stand for questions.
Okay, with that, I'll open it up for member questions discussion. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the testifier, give us some background. How long has the electric bus program been in effect, and what are the results so far? How many buses, and why the reason for the extension?
Ms. Polish?
Chair, Representative Anderson, the original funding was passed in 2023. We've had two rounds of funding so far. Representative Anderson, I'll have to follow up with you to get you the exact number. We just released another round of funding, so that went live about a month ago. We would expect to have the next round closed by the end of this year, but we wanted a little bit more time to allow for the folks who get an award this year. The timeline for an electric school bus, it just takes a little time, and they don't actually order the bus until they're under contract. And so they might not have the bus and be able to invoice us. That's why we asked for the date to be pushed back by a year so that we can get all of those buses ordered, get the invoice in, and then make the payment.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up. Was that funding in 2023 one time, or is it continued funding?
Chair and Representative, it was one time.
Anything else? Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Aikum, for bringing this. And so
Assistant Commissioner, I have a question about the heat pump program. Can you help us understand, like, the importance of the kind of decoupling of the funding or of the, I guess, of the programs, and who would be most likely to benefit from the heat pump program?
Ms. Polish.
Chair and Representative. Right now, we've been waiting for news from the Department of Energy to actually proceed with implementation of the two programs. One is stuck in a conditional status. The other has been moving forward. We submitted documents last July, and we were just waiting for the final approval. We keep hearing that approval is imminent, but I think the reason to potentially decouple them, at least in terms of getting things launched, is to facilitate folks being able to move forward. One of the things that we're quite excited about with the heat pump program is it is an opportunity, particularly for folks who either use electric resistance heat now and or use delivered fuels, to have another mechanism to serve their heating needs, and one that is, you know, more stable, more reliable, and may have less pressure on the low-income home energy assistance program that we also operate. So we're excited to see that move forward and see adoption around the state.
Representative Jones.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, I just think it goes to highlight how important this bill is so that we can get that money out the door and flowing towards Minnesotans.
Representative Sexton.
Thank you, Chair. My question revolves around the residential heat pump as well. I understand you want to open it up to renters. Could you expound upon what drove that decision?
Ms. Polish.
Chair and Representative, it aligns with two different things. One is that the federal program also allows that, and so we really want to be able to make sure that when the federal program becomes available, folks really are able to stack both those federal and state incentives, so that helps with that alignment. There also now are heat pumps that are considered window unit heat pumps, and that would facilitate adoption of that technology for those kinds of residents and making sure that they can get that energy efficient option.
Representative Sexton, follow up?
Yeah, I guess my follow-up was more along the traditional heat pump that's fully installed, which is part of the bill. And my concern is we have a little fraud problem here in Minnesota. So if the renter moves on, the owner obviously owns the heat pump,
mm-hmm.
and there's nothing stopping them from relocating that heat pump into their own home that was basically taxpayer funded. So I just have a concern that that's going to be hard to implement, and we should be doing things that should avoid fraud.
Ms. Polish, do you
Chair
like to respond?
Representative, I will certainly make sure that the team has all of those concerns top of mind. There are lots of requirements to make sure that the folks that are getting the benefit of these rebates are going through all of the necessary channels and making the necessary both energy assessments, audits, updates, and permitting to get those projects done. We'll make sure that we're keeping on top of it.
And I fully agree, if I may, Chair. I fully agree with all the front end.
Yes.
I just know that as soon as that person leaves the house, there's absolutely no control over what happens with everything that was installed.
Okay. Final questions, Representative Swidzinski.
Just kind of another question. Thank you, Ms. Polish. So why is in the bill, it looks like Commerce is seeking to maybe expand some partnerships with private entities and NGOs. Does the department not currently do that? Are they not allowed to do that? And then why could you how would this new authority potentially impact?
Ms. Polish.
Chair and Representative Swidzinski, thank you for the question. This actually, this does expand our ability to create formal partnerships with folks like National Labs, the National Governors Association, MISO, to do the energy security planning work. We didn't currently have that statutory authority and had done it as part of federal authority that we had been given. As those federal requirements sunset, we're hoping to make sure that that exists in state statute to codify the fact that that kind of coordination, information, and data sharing is essential, and that we have the ability to do that in an ongoing way.
Good. Final comments, Chair. Mr. Cherrycomb.
Thank you for the conversation and the questions. I, as the author of the original heat pump bill, am excited that we can get things moving. I have literally people in my district who have been asking about it for several years. So I do think this is great, important, and can be very beneficial to all of us. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And with that, House File 4559, as amended, is laid over. Next, we have House File 4374. Chair Akam, tell us.
Yes, I would like to move House File 4374 before the committee.
I'd like a roll call. And if she could explain the amendment.
Too, yes, absolutely.
Before we get to
roll
that
call,
point.
Roll call having been requested, it'll be done. Tell us about the amendment.
Yes, and we do have an amendment today, and maybe with that, as far as explaining the amendment, I'll talk about the whole bill in its entirety. We all come to the Capitol with the goal of making Minnesota a better state and making the lives of those who live here better. We've all spent the last several months working on bills and having hearings from stakeholders and community members with the goal of passing legislation. House File 4374, as amended, is a small package of bipartisan, non-controversial bills that will keep our state moving forward. The bill includes Representative Mecklen's Petro Fund bill. It includes all of the agencies and commissions, PUC commissions technical bills. It includes Representative Sexton's fuel switching bill, and it includes Representative Igoe's nuclear study. These are bills we've heard in committee. While there are many other provisions that I would have certainly preferred to include as well, I recognize they are more controversial and do not make sense at this time. This is a small but meaningful step, and I ask for your support for House File 4374 as amended and as was asked. We'll have a roll call. I appreciate that.
Okay, just to be clear, I don't know that we actually ever did, but we'll move the A1 amendment for House File 4374.
Thank you.
Further comments, discussion on the amendment?
Go ahead.
Representative Igoe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Madam Chair, I mean, I appreciate you mentioned that the nuclear study is in this delete all amendment, but what was done to the bill upon reading the amendment, I wouldn't call this Representative Igoe's nuclear study bill anymore. I count 10 new provisions in the bill without any conversation between myself or Prairie Island that I'm aware of. And I know in the conversation we had the bill in front of us that we were going to sit down and talk about it before we worked on any amendments. And I was copacetic to making the changes. I know in our last conversation we talked about waiting until we saw where the Senate bill was at to try and pull provisions together to limit conference opportunity. So seeing this in front of us today without having a conversation or even working on this together, that's why I can't support your delete all amendment today, because there has been no collaboration. We spent 18 months working on the bill that we got to right now with stakeholders and everyone involved. So to have this brought up today, I think is just in bad form and bad taste of our process here. So unfortunately, I have to give you a no vote on this today.
Chair Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Igoe. I think when we heard the nuclear study bill in committee, you heard from many people on our side of the aisle with things that were important to be included in the bill. You're right. When you and I talked yesterday, we talked about what was happening in the Senate, and this bill has one additional provision from what was passed in the Senate, and what was passed in the Senate was worked on with labor, with both sides of the aisle. And so to talk about no collaboration, that's far from the truth. I spoke with Representative Buck right before the hearing today and asked if there had been any conversation or follow-up between the two of you from when we initially heard, and indicated that there wasn't any. So I think that we worked hard to try and reach out to you. You were going to get back to me after we talked yesterday. And so it wasn't because we weren't trying. We knew that if we were going to have a chance at any type of a bill coming out of this, and especially about something that I think everybody around this table agrees was a valid and important provision. And so while I can understand your disappointment, I think there were a lot of opportunities. And so it just because things are being worked on today, we still have weeks left. So there's still time and there's still an opportunity. I think that us moving this bill out of committee today keeps those things alive. Us letting it languish in committee, sadly, it will languish.
Other? Chair Swedzinski.
Thank you, Chair Kraft, and to Representative Igoe's comments too. You know, I think when we think about organizations and bringing groups together of a wide consensus, and part of our job, you know, as chairs is talking about the issues, talking about the policies, talking about spending, and, you know, this committee is allowed to pass one bill out in this committee this week. And, you know, as we contemplate the issues that we have before us, we have RDA, we have DFL priorities, we have Republican priorities, and dividing those things out in a meaningful way that sets the stage for what you may prioritize and what we prioritize are two different things. And I think when we're looking at policy decisions, when it comes to finding consensus, when it comes to finding reasonable compromise on a study, this bill was not about ending the moratorium, not about beginning building a nuclear plant tomorrow. This is about studying it and what that means to the state of Minnesota. And the idea that you would go against such a large group of consensus makers, just in an amendment, I think speaks to the fact of how difficult it is to actually move legislation from an RDA spending standpoint to a policy standpoint when it comes to energy. And oftentimes we're told that divided government is sometimes rough government, but in some cases it's very important that many voices are at the table. And that sometimes means we disagree. And so, you know, I support our members, but I think this was, you know, I think we got some work we can do potentially, but I don't think, you know, a miniature omnibus is the route to take today. So, thank you. I think,
Dave. Representative Baker.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Ecom, thank you for visiting with me also last week about maybe some way of working through some of this stuff. You know, I think what I thought about here, too, after sort of like looking at the language of the RDA, how we'd like to use half of it and you only want to use half again, this is how kind of this forced bipartisanship has to work. But the DFL isn't in charge anymore. And I don't know if some members know that or feel it yet, because it's been like a while. We've been a long time in the minority. And so to not have bipartisanship today or this week, this final week of our committee, and to not just sit down with any members that are going to have issues with this, especially, again, co-chairs. And again, I'm not going to lecture anybody, because I have that in my own committee. But to see the work that Representative Igoe did on just the nuclear stuff alone and the bipartisanship that was almost there was one member that abstained, the work he did with the Prairie Island community, the work that he did with everything, and to change it so much without really being clear about can you support this or not before it came in front of us today is a disappointment, because what I wouldn't want to see happen is the House not have a bill at all. Whatever is happening in the other body, okay, that's fine. I kind of don't care. We have to put out a bill that we can live with, because they're not tied like we are. We're in a historic moment here, and I just hope that we can save this, and get bipartisan support on a bill that makes us all think that we can move forward with something. And I think, again, if Igoe's bill can have some tweaks to it, that's up to him and again the chairs. I think that but again, I'm disappointed in the process of how this sort of feels like it's just like, here it is, we made some changes, and it just, I think it could have been handled better. So I hope that we remember that this is a very historic moment for us, and I hope that we can come together and find a way to do this right. But I can't, again, out of workforce and labor, I can't pass anything without Pinto's approval of this. So we're just going to get along, and we're going to do what we can get along. So I hope that we don't push too far and don't communicate well enough. I hope that we can do this. So just more of a statement, Mr. Chair. That's it.
Chair Ecom.
Thank you. I would like to respond to that. And I think you're right. Neither of us are in the majority in this body. And because of that, the provisions that were included here were bipartisan and had broad support within our committee. And so as Co-Chair Swazinski and I started having conversations last week about what could or should be included, it is, and I'm sure what you're finding out in your committee as well, Representative Baker, that you both have to agree. You have to find, I mean, it's where you both have to agree. And so when things were presented to the co-chair that weren't, that there wasn't support, we withdrew. And so when there were things that were presented to us that we didn't agree with, we didn't include. Now, was it our hope that the negotiations and the conversations between the co-chairs would continue? It was. Unfortunately, that's not what happened. The last time we heard anything was Friday afternoon. And so we've been here now. It's Tuesday afternoon. Heard nothing in response to our latest offer, which was this. Oops, excuse me. And so I certainly appreciate your focus on process. It's important. And we have to recognize that if the other side doesn't agree, that that isn't going to get passed. It's not going to make the muster. As far as the nuclear study, I will say our side has been strongly opposed until this year. There was an opportunity. And the only thing that's different between what was a compromise between a lot of voices was one provision that was important to many of us on our side, and that was in terms of looking at the levelized cost or in cost analysis of different types of generation. Now, that's not a controversial provision. At least I don't think it is. And so I think if that's a game, or if that's the deal breaker, then I guess that's a deal breaker. I don't think that that is that controversial. So I understand if people don't appreciate that other things aren't included in this. This is the last opportunity our side had for the gavel to be able to offer bills. And so with that and a lack of communication or coordination, we kind of felt like we didn't have a choice. It's either do nothing or try a Hail Mary. So that's what we tried. And it could, as I said to Representative Igo yesterday when we talked, this maybe isn't going to work, and that's okay. And no can be a fine answer. And I, you know, it's a full sentence. No is a full sentence. So I completely understand perspectives and know that this wasn't without effort from our side to focus on the process and to find areas of agreement. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Buck.
I can guarantee you that if there is a bill that Prairie Island has had a hand in, I've reached out to them. They're my first contact when it came to the additions. So they have been part of the process along with others. And it feels like, and this may not be the intention, but I just want to let everyone know how it can be perceived. There have been times in history during my 12 years as tribal council that we were used as pawns at Prairie Island. We were used as the excuse for something not getting done that one side or the other wanted to get done. And now it feels like we're being used again on this. Prairie Island's stance was as long as the things that they wanted were in here, they were neutral in others. So I didn't see any of their lobbyists here to confirm that, but that's my conversations with them. So Padame Ayepi.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Akam, for bringing this forward, Chair Akam, for bringing this forward. It's disappointing to hear the other side of the aisle not feeling like they've been heard or they're being represented in this bill. I can tell you I'm getting outreach from my community right now that's saying, why did we agree to a nuclear study? And there's nothing in there that reflects what my district wanted. I have a bunch of RDA projects. I have the Thermal Energy Network. I have a bunch of things that my district really was asking for. And when they look at that amendment, that language, they're telling me these are all Republican priorities, all of them, except for the couple of agency things. But those are agency bills. And so there's nobody more disappointed by this amendment than me, I would say. And I'm still going to vote for it. And I think one of the things we have to ask ourselves at the legislature, because I've been here in a Democratic trifecta, and I've been here in divided legislature when we had to make compromises with the other body. And I think one of the things that we have to ask ourselves is, are we here to get our way, or are we here to get things done for the people of Minnesota? And I recognize that I'm not going to get my way. And that sucks, and it sucks for my community that's asking for this, but I'm going to vote for this because it's still getting things done for Minnesotans. It's still moving the goalposts forward in what we were sent here to do. And frankly, doing nothing, I'm not paid to sit here and do nothing. I'm paid to advocate for what people want. I'm paid to represent my district and my community. And I'm also paid to respond to them and say, yeah, it's not exactly what we wanted. But you know what? A nuclear study is a good idea. And maybe we need to learn more about it, right? We've had this conversation, Representative Iko and I. Maybe we need to learn more about it. That's something that I'm open to. And it might not be exactly what you wanted to see, but it is more information so that we can make better decisions in the future. And I guess what I'm just trying to say, it's not a question, it's more of a comment, is like, are we here to get exactly what we want, or are we here to make compromises, to keep communicating, to keep negotiating, and try to move forward? And I believe that's what we're here for. I know that's what I'm here for. So I'm going to be voting in favor of it. Thank you.
Final comments, Representative Baker?
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And I guess I want to go back to Representative Buck's comment that the reason I spoke about the Prairie Island support was I clearly heard Mr. Johnson a few weeks ago from the community saying they supported the IGO bill. They didn't say they were neutral. They supported it. Again, when we get to that place because of the historic process that has not been fair to Prairie Island, has been recognized, I believe, and I think the efforts of IGO and others have been very remarkable. I remember that clearly said they were supportive of that. So I just want to be on the record saying I didn't hear them say neutral, like you just said. I want to make sure we're clear on that. So that's all. So I wanted to clear the record up, what I heard in testimony. Thank you.
Representative Buck.
Madam Mayor, yeah, thank you. Just to clarify what I said, they are supportive of those their initial initiatives that they wanted in there. And they said as long as those initial initiatives are still in there, they're neutral on the rest of it. So as long as those issues are still there, they're supportive of the overall neutral and the additions.
Okay. Chair, do you have any final comments on the amendment you'd like to make before we vote on the amendment?
No.
Okay. With that, we're going to do a roll call. Representative Iko.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify something, too, that when by no means when I was working on this bill and we were talking about, especially when you were talking about Representative Buck, the things of the past, the reason I'm so protective of this language is because I did give a community and a tribal council my word that I would work in good faith and honor my word that I wouldn't do anything that they weren't in agreement on. So that's why I'm so protective of the bill. I would never, ever consider to use any group of people as pawns, and especially working in legislation. So I just want to make sure that's clear, and that by no means is that in my heart at all.
Chair Iko.
Just briefly, and please also, everyone know that we did reach out to Prairie Island and say, do you support this language? And the answer was, we support it if those things are in, just as Representative Buck said. So, with that, Mr. Chair.
I want to quickly make. A lot of process stuff has been talked about. A no is fine. A no could have been given on this on Friday afternoon, on Saturday, on Sunday, on Monday, even this morning.
Yep.
It was a choice for your side to wait till to this time to say no. With that, the clerk will take the roll on the A1 amendment.
Chair Acomb.
Aye.
Chair Acomb, aye. Chair Swidzinski.
No.
Chair Swidzinski, no. Vice Chair Kraft.
Aye.
Vice Chair Kraft, aye. Vice Chair Murphy. Vice Chair Murphy, no. Representative Anderson.
Anderson, no.
Representative Anderson, no. Representative Baker. Representative Baker, no. Representative Buck.
Huh, yes.
Representative Buck, aye. Representative Carroll.
Aye.
Representative Carroll, aye. Representative Hollins.
Hollins, aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Igo.
Igo, no.
Representative Igo, nay. Representative Jones.
Aye.
Representative Jones, aye. Representative Luger Nicolai.
Aye.
Representative Luger Nicolai, aye. Representative Mahmood.
Aye.
Representative Mahmood, aye. Representative Meckland.
Nay.
Representative Meckland, nay. Representative Sexton.
No.
Representative Sexton, nay. Representative Wiener.
No.
Representative Wiener, nay.
With 8 ayes and 8 nays, the amendment is not adopted. Madam Chair, you want to talk about the bill before we lay it over?
Sure. I guess maybe instead of the bill, we've talked about the bill. What I think I want to ensure that the rest of the committee members know that it's up to us as members of this body and of this committee to be working towards something and to passing the things that we agree on. And so my question to all of you is, what is your suggestion about how to do that? And so anyway, that's clearly a rhetorical question, but I certainly would be interested. We've got, looks like about 48 hours. And we'll see what comes. But with that, Mr. Chair, I think we'll go ahead and lay the bill over.
Okay, with that, House File 4374 is laid over. We're gonna swap now.
Right. Next on our agenda, we have House File 2317, Representative Kraft. Would you like to go ahead and move your bill?
Yep, move House File 2317 to be laid over.
And I think there's an author's amendment.
There is. I'd like to move the A3 amendment, which puts an appropriation amount in and updates some dates.
I believe it's the A4.
The A4. Is it A4?
Yes, A4.
Ah.
Yeah.
Sorry, there was an A3 in here too. Yeah, so thank you very much. I'll move the A4 amendment. Please disregard the A3.
Great, the A4. Any discussion to the A4? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Kraft, please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House File 2317 is really exciting. It is about leveraging an almost entirely untapped source of heat that already exists in hundreds of Minnesota communities around the state, wastewater. After wastewater is treated, it has heat in it. House File 2317 is simply about figuring out how to use this free renewable heat, free in that we're already paying for it, to provide thermal energy to buildings. Not only can it help us with one of our biggest challenges, decarbonizing the building sector, but it just makes sense to reuse heat energy that we're already creating. You may remember that we commissioned a Thermal Energy Network Deployment Workgroup that reported to us in December 2025. That workgroup identified wastewater as a key local thermal resource and recommended prioritizing areas with access to renewable thermal resources like wastewater. Many wastewater treatment facilities already recover some waste heat internally for their own processes. What this bill targets is different. The thermal energy in the treated wastewater itself, which is currently being discharged into our rivers and waterways. This is energy communities have already paid to generate, and right now we're not using it. Recent studies conducted in St. Paul and Duluth in conjunction with federal grant opportunities identified enough recoverable thermal energy at wastewater treatment facilities to serve as the primary energy source for the district heating networks serving approximately 40 million square feet of building space. This is not really technically challenging. The question for Minnesota is where and how to deploy it. House File 2317 would fund a pilot program through the MPCA to answer that question. A study directs the MPCA to identify facilities statewide where this thermal energy could feasibly be captured and put to use. And it funds engineering review and design for two projects, one in the 7-county metro and one outstate. So this is about figuring out how to use a widely available, untapped, renewable thermal resource to decarbonize building heating. Seems like an excellent fit for the RDA. Now I have a testifier.
Thank you, Chair Akam, members of the committee. My name is Luke Galzer, President and CEO with Evergreen Energy. We develop and operate district energy systems and thermal energy networks across the United States. I'm here today because wastewater treatment facilities across Minnesota contain a significant, largely untapped source of thermal energy that can provide communities with affordable, low-carbon, locally sourced heating. In St. Paul, we're working with the Metropolitan Council Environmental Services and the city on Clean Heat St. Paul, an effort to capture waste heat from the state's largest wastewater treatment facility and integrate it with our existing district heating network. In Duluth, we recently completed a federally funded study confirming the availability of the resource and to find how best to integrate with the city's district heating network. These are two of Minnesota's hundreds of wastewater treatment facilities, some of which may provide real opportunities for communities. The technology is proven, deployed at scale in Europe since the 1980s with several smaller projects in operation across North America. The question for Minnesota is where the best opportunities are and how to move them forward. This bill helps answer that question. Wastewater heat is local, it's secure, it's low carbon, it's available year-round, and can help insulate communities from global energy price volatility. Communities that understand what energy resources they have can make better decisions about local infrastructure, economic development, and long-term energy planning. This bill complements the thermal energy network deployment framework this legislature has been building and puts actionable information in communities' hands of all shapes and sizes. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, there's a, we had that put in the letter in the packet. So.
Representative Kraft, thank you very much for bringing this forward. I lived in Iceland where we had hot water like that all the time, the endless shower, so to speak. I kind of like the way this bill is going. I was just going to throw out an idea that may work a little bit better. If we were to give a prize to somebody who came forward with a good project, one in the metro area and one in greater Minnesota, of $1 million or something towards design, that may save us just a whole bunch of engineering costs up front. Having worked for an engineering firm, if you give them $3 million, they'll spend $3 million. If you give them $350,000, they'll spend $350,000. It'd be a minor A5 amendment, but I think it might actually work better and encourage competition for the skin in the game of getting the best prize to get the overall prize to do the event. Thank you.
Representative Pratt.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Sexton, thank you for your creativity. I'm excited to explore that with you. Let's follow up.
Any other questions or comments from members? Seeing none, this bill is being laid over, so there is time to continue to work on it. And with that, Representative Kraft, do you have any closing comments?
This is a great bill. Makes sense to there's many ways I could bad jokes I can make, which I'm not going to do. So but please support the bill.
Great. With that, House File 2317, as amended, is laid over. Next on our agenda, we have House File 3179, and Representative Jones is making her way to the testifier table. Representative Jones, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I'd like to, and I have an amendment I'd like to move.
Great. So. House File 3179 will be laid over, and there is an amendment, the A1. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. 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 Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Representative Jones, go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Akam, Swazinski, and members of the committee for the opportunity to present House File 3179. If you want to lower bills for residents and businesses, if you value clean air, and if you value having a stable climate,
I've got a bill for you. As we've talked many times in this committee, the cheapest and cleanest form of energy is the one that is never used. When we make buildings more energy efficient, we use less energy, thereby making bills lower and reducing pollution from energy generation. Using less energy also makes us less vulnerable to energy shocks, whether they're global energy shocks, whether they're due to things like Winter Storm Uri, boats stuck in the Suez Canal, or a president like Trump who insists on aggressively promoting natural gas exports to the detriment of U.S. residents and businesses. The result of this last one, the Henry Hub gas price, the benchmark for U.S. gas prices, was 60% higher in 2025 than 2024. When we use less energy, we're less vulnerable to impacts such as those drastic increases. For all of those reasons, we have House File 3179, Large Building Energy Performance Standards. This is a systematic process for large buildings in Minnesota to reduce their energy usage, drive down emissions, and to cut operational costs for those buildings. Buildings are often the most valuable assets that residents or businesses own. Yet we don't think about whether the performance of these buildings is fully serving us in the most efficient way. As an analogy, we do consider the energy performance of other valuable assets, vehicles. We have MPG, or miles per gallon, as the metric to understand car efficiency. The federal EPA's Corporate Average Fuel Economy, or CAFE, standards establish minimum MPG efficiency targets that manufacturers must meet over time. The aim of this bill does the same for building energy. It establishes a framework to reduce the amount of energy used to heat and cool buildings, power equipment, along with other energy services in buildings. The fuel economy equivalent in buildings is EUI, or energy use intensity. This bill directs the Department of Commerce to establish EUI targets for buildings in five-year increments. These targets are to be aligned with the greenhouse gas reductions of 90% for the portfolio, so that's the whole group of buildings, it's about 6,000 to 7,000 of them, covered by the year 2045 from a 2005 baseline. This is in line with what is already in statute for a carbon neutral economy in 2050. The bill has off-ramps for building owners that are experiencing financial distress or buildings that have over 50% vacancy, are not being used, or scheduled for demolition. The bill also establishes a grant program within the Department of Commerce to assist building owners to make improvements that reduce the energy use intensity. I want this bill to be successful, and that means ensuring that the buildings can do those retrofits. And that is why I am committed to passing a bill that has retrofit funding available, not only through eco programs, but new sources as well. Elements of this bill take a similar approach to Minnesota's incredibly successful renewable energy standard. When it was first enacted, many people thought that the standards were too ambitious, but Minnesota rose to the challenge and repeatedly is going to meet the standard early. We even expanded it to include the carbon-free standard. This bill has been informed by many stakeholder conversations with building owners and managers, labor, utilities, consumer advocates, and more. Before joining the legislature, I worked for an energy efficiency nonprofit and spearheaded a series of workshops on BPS. I'm committed to continue to listen to stakeholders and further conversations to develop this bill in a way that it best serves Minnesotans. Thanks again, and I look forward to the discussion.
And it looks like we have a couple of testifiers. Are we going virtual first? Great. Online, I believe we have Marshall Duer-Balkland, Director, Institute of Market Transformation. Please unmute yourself and go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed. Are you there, Mr. Balkland? Are we not hearing you, maybe? There, I see you now. Oh, come back. There you are. We see you, but we're not hearing you. So why don't we see if we can fix that, and we'll switch up our testifiers. So we'll go to Will Nyssen with Center for Energy and the Environment. Welcome to committee. Please go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Akam, members of the committee. My name is Will Nyssen. I'm Director of Policy at Center for Energy and Environment. Throughout our four-year history, CEE has supported policies and programs that improve the energy efficiency of Minnesota's building stock. These efforts have resulted in lower energy bills for the people and businesses who participate in those programs, lower costs for all ratepayers as we continue building efficiency as a utility system resource, and lower emissions as we use less energy overall. We were a key stakeholder in establishing the existing benchmarking program in the state, where large buildings report energy data to track performance over time. We've also been involved in discussions around a building performance standard. At a high level, we think a standard that builds on that benchmarking program could help drive energy savings in the large commercial building market. NEBPS should have reasonable and achievable targets, come with significant technical and financial resources to assist building owners and operators to make efficiency upgrades, and account for the realities of the large commercial building market. As a helpful building block, as Representative Jones mentioned, our utility eco programs offer a great foundation for providing that technical and financial support for cost-effective efficiency improvements. These programs can support and complement any additional funding that comes from other sources. Lastly, CEE appreciates the engagement from many other parties on this issue over the past few years, as evidenced by the number of letters submitted on this bill. And even though there is some disagreement on substance in those letters, many of them broadly support energy efficiency as a way to save energy and reduce costs. So we appreciate Representative Jones's leadership on this issue and look forward to continued work with stakeholders in the coming months.
Thank you, Mr. Nissen. I think, are we going to circle back to a virtual testifier? Please go ahead and unmute yourself and introduce yourself for the record. No? Can you eat? Could he call in? Are there anyone else that want to testify to the bill? And what's that? Questions from members? You're multitasking. Any questions from members? Representative Sexton.
Thank you, Chair. I may have a couple. I'm trying to understand the connection between energy use intensity, which is defined as the total energy consumed by the building divided by the square foot. Mm-hmm. And we take that in 2005. But that crosses over into the real focus of the bill and the program is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from covered buildings by 90%. So when we're measuring energy use and we keep all those measurements, but the target is actually measured in the reduction of greenhouse gas, right? But there's a gap there. Can you explain the gap?
Representative Jones.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Sexton, for the question. So I think what's important is for me, I didn't want to be picking numbers out of thin air, right? I think we should be basing our legislation or any targets that we're setting on something that has as either currently in statute or it's going to towards a larger goal. And we don't have any larger energy efficiency targets in our current statutes, but we do have greenhouse gas emissions. And I have been in conversations with St. Lawrence Berkeley National Labs. Like, we can model, essentially, especially given our benchmarking data that we have, we can take a look at the energy efficiency of our building stock and the greenhouse gas emissions associated with them, essentially creating a greenhouse gas to energy factor, so that we can establish that target setting, so that it will eventually get us to the greenhouse gas emissions target. Since we do have that that carbon neutral goal by 2050 in statute, I backed out a little bit to 2045, knowing that like that last 10% is always the hardest. So let's not go all the way there. Let's be a little bit, try to be practical about this. And so we can take that time to see where the technology takes us to get that last 10%.
Representative Sexton, do you have any follow-up?
Oh, yes. If we're trying to put this in terms that building owners, investors, insurance agents, everybody else can understand in valuing the building, it seems like a direct correlation would be easier. You know, we already know and we can measure the mm-hmm. use of energy. We go back to 2005, what'd your meter say? Whether it's gas or electric meter, you can read that. You can go, okay, I use this much for this particular month, add it all up, divide by the square footage, I've got that for the entire year. Mm-hmm. But now we're taking it through a gonculator, so to speak, and giving a correlation of a greenhouse gas number And then we have to reduce that number by 90%. I think a lot of people are going to scratch their head and go, why am I doing this that way?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Sexton. I'm happy to continue talking about this and which is the best metric to use. Actually, during the workshops that we held, this was a major topic of conversation because, actually, unfortunately, that our other testifier couldn't speak because he was going to talk about how there are some BPS, building performance standards. Oh, we've got him on the line. Exist in many places, so maybe we'll go to him.
Would that be appropriate?
Yes, and then we'll get back to you.
No, he's gone now.
He's back. But can we hear him?
Can you keep talking? The testifier is online. Can you keep talking? Is it your picture comes up?
Keep talking.
Turn your mouth. Keep talking.
I can also call him and put him.
I was wondering if maybe this is because we didn't get that telegraph report earlier in committee that.
Hi, is it okay if we put you on a mic this way? All right, hold on. All right, can you speak, Marshall?
I can speak. Can you all hear me now?
Okay. All right, keep going.
Yeah, you can hear me.
Yes, we can hear you.
Great. I do apologize for the audio problems. All right, so thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3179. My name is Marshall Duobalkind. I'm the Director of Policy and Codes for the Institute for Market Transformation, a national nonpartisan nonprofit organization. I am two partners with government, businesses, communities to improve the efficiency and performance of buildings for the people inside them, the communities around them, with a leading national expert on standards like the one that would be created under this bill. As we've already heard, the U.S. is facing surging demand for electricity and energy from many sources, including growth of data centers, and this is accelerating the affordability crisis. Even as many people are struggling to pay their bills, which might make it strange to be talking about reducing energy use, but that makes it precisely the right time. As you heard Representative Jones speak to, energy efficiency is the first and cheapest source of energy available. Investing in energy efficiency yields economic dividends, multiple times cost of investments, and have beneficial outcomes for everyone. Not only is efficiency important for affordability, it's critical to meeting the climate crisis. Nationwide, buildings are responsible for about one-third of all GHG emissions. Here in, say, Minneapolis, they represent about 71% of emissions, and I think that's actually a more relevant metric than, in some ways, than the statewide, because this bill is innovative in applying to the metro area specifically. Those statistics are similar to other metro areas. We have building energy codes here in Minnesota, which have cost-effectively kept energy use relatively flat for a long time, but over three-quarters of all the buildings that will be used in 25 years are already built. Less than 1-2% of these buildings are renovated annually, and at that rate, we're going to take 50 years or more to renovate all the buildings, which is too late for the statewide goals. That's where building performance standards come in, or building energy performance standards, the most innovative and successful policy approach we see to solving this problem in large buildings. In general, as you've heard, it applies to all large buildings over a certain size, set specific either energy or emission goals. Some jurisdictions have used EUI, energy use intensity. Others have used greenhouse gas emissions. Some have used a combination or both, and requires meeting those goals by specific years with long-term targets and a lot of flexibility, including especially for, say, affordable housing. I provided handouts to the committee that delve deeper into the key elements and benefits of a BPS, so I won't belabor that further. I also provided the committee a map, which shows that there are now 16 BPS policies in effect in the U.S., including at the statewide level in Maryland, Colorado, Washington, and Oregon. We have 34 more jurisdictions across the U.S. that have committed to passing a bill like this in the coming years, including the states of California, Massachusetts, and Hawaii. Our modeling shows that if all these cities and states adopted these policies, it would produce energy savings that would eliminate the need for more than 100 new gas power plants, which again, given the rising cost of natural gas, is very, very important, to say nothing of the carbon emissions. We've been closely involved with all of these policies, and I can report they're working, and we're learning lessons, and that is being implemented in the next wave of policies like the one that's before us today. The first compliance deadlines for BPS policies occurred last year, 2025, and we're already seeing significant success, including high compliance rates, higher uptake in utility efficiency programs, and energy use reductions, not only in buildings that don't meet those initial targets, but also in other buildings that are looking towards longer-term planning. And this is where I think a BPS is really, really innovative, because it accelerates what we're seeing already, a shift in the building industry to strategic long-term planning. There are cost-effective technologies and practices to reduce energy use and emissions in virtually all buildings that would be covered by this policy. And those are the most cost-effective, and building owners are most likely to want to implement them when existing equipment is being replaced. And we also know that all major heating and cooling equipment in these buildings last 20 to 30 years on average. And so almost all the buildings covered by this policy will be doing an equipment replacement sometime between now and 2050. And probably only once. We have one bite at the apple for all of these buildings to get energy efficiency reductions in the most efficient way and most cost-effective way possible. And experience shows that voluntary action is not enough. Without a regulatory signal like the one in this bill, building owners don't take advantage of this critical window to get deeper energy cost and emission savings, and even though that does yield long-term benefits and higher net present value for them. And a well-designed BPS, such as the one that's been introduced by Representative Jones, Kraft, Long, and Roar, is a really good way to fix this. Well, I want to congratulate them on developing a bill that incorporates many of these best practices from across the country, especially the creation of a building and performance advisory committee for strong accountability and local contexts, such as special considerations for cold weather. And doing it at the state level is better aligned with utility regulations, utility incentives, and stronger accountability. As I already spoke about, it also this applies primarily to the large metro areas in the state, not to the whole state, which is innovative, and we think. I do.
Mr. Balkin, can we get you to wrap up, please?
I do recognize, I agree, I've read many of the letters that you've received. People speak a lot about the support of this being dependent on the scale of support provided, success of this. However, not all this funding is needed right away. It doesn't need to be figured out all before the passage of the bill, because there are initial compliance measures for most buildings that are low cost and yield immediate financial savings, and utility programs can step in, which is also allowed by this policy.
Marshall, can you wrap up?
Yeah, I can wrap up. I'm actually at the end of my testimony, so thank you for the time. I'll just say it's not uncommon for policies to set EUI targets, but then use a long-term GHG goal as a sort of guiding light for setting appropriate efficiency targets. That's a known best practice. So
thank you so much for your time,
and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you so much, Marshall. I'll be in touch. Thank you for your testimony. We've got two questions, and then we're going to need to move on. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any cost estimates on what the upgrades are going to cost for a typical building?
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. So as we heard from our testifier is that a lot – so this is a long-term bill, right? We've got 2045 as the end target. And so lots of this equipment is going to reach end of life, and so we're going to need to be upgrading it anyway. So there will be investments in any case. The other thing is that there is no, in some ways, there's no average building. This, you know, this group of buildings, the 6,000 to 7,000 buildings, is it's made up of offices, multifamily buildings, libraries, all sorts of buildings. And so, saying an average wouldn't quite be if I spit out a number, it wouldn't be accurate because so many of these buildings are very different.
A brief follow-up, Representative Murphy.
First of all, if the cost of buildings go up because of the cost of, you know, if they do, who pays for it?
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. If the cost of buildings go, I'm assuming you mean the cost of utility. Can you clarify what you mean there?
The cost of the property. Representative Murphy. When you're building a piece of property and you're trying to have, you have an estimate of what it would cost, if it goes up, who will end up paying for that?
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. So this applies to existing buildings. This is not for new construction.
Great. I'll just follow up with that. You know, we have a trend here. The trend is that we add expense at no cost to anyone, but we always pass it on to everybody that uses it. So whether it's renters or whether it's customers, people think that doesn't actually apply to me because I have the business pay for it. When reality is, we all pay for it. So if it does go up, and it doesn't seem like we have an idea of what will happen long term, but when we raise the price of properties, especially for businesses, those businesses pass it on. Thank you.
Great. And last questions from Representative Swazinski. I see your hand up, Representative Sexton. Maybe what we can do is you can follow up offline. This bill is being laid over so conversations can continue. Representative Swazinski. Okay. Any final comments, Representative Jones?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I mentioned extensively, the major point of this bill is energy efficiency, and when we make buildings more energy efficient, we save money for the owners and tenants. So I was looking forward to starting this conversation. Look forward to continuing more because we want to make this bill right for Minnesotans. Thanks.
With that, the bill is laid over.
All right, while Chair Ekum gets over there, I'll go ahead and move House File 4860 before the committee. 4880. Yeah, moving 4880 before the committee to be laid over. And I believe there's a amendment. Madam Chair, do you want to move the amendment?
There is. There's an A2, please. Yes. To get the bill in the shape, I would like to consider it.
Okay. Chair Ekum moves to A2. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye. Aye. Any opposed? The motion is adopted. The A2 is adopted. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. A thriving residential solar and storage market requires consumer trust. House File 4880, as amended, is the result of a working group that was initiated by the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association, MNSEIA, with members from industry, along with the Department of Commerce and the Attorney General's office. The bill establishes standards and requirements for every residential solar company and salesperson operating in our state. In short, the bill increases accountability for salespeople and requires registration with the Department of Commerce, who can revoke or deny any registration for inappropriate practices. The bill requires standardized sales disclosure and contract terms. And the bill creates record retention requirements and liability to identify patterns of misrepresentation, document violations, and enforce penalties under Minnesota consumer protection laws. At least 8 other states have passed similar protections to protect their markets and customers, and it's time for Minnesota to join that group. And there are a few people, we have some testifiers.
Okay, first up, Ms. Webby, why don't you introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Kraft and Chair Swazinski. Thank you so much, Chair Ekum, for bringing this bill forward. My name is Sarah Webby. I'm the Director of Policy and Regulatory Affairs for the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association, MNSEIA. As Representative Ekum shared, MNSEIA shares the vision that a thriving residential and storage market is based in strong consumer trust. MNSEIA members already hold themselves to a voluntary code of conduct to maintain this trust. This includes requirements to present the capabilities of the systems that they're selling honestly, quote, realistic prices, employ trained salespeople, and avoid deceptive practices in everything that we do. These are the right standards for ethical solar and storage sales. However, they are voluntary commitments that only bind our members and only as a condition of their membership. Bad actors are operating outside of our association. They don't have any equivalent obligation. And consumers have no reliable way to distinguish between ethical companies and companies that will deceive them. These gaps are exactly why we implemented a working group and collaboratively developed the language in House File 4880. Our goal was straightforward. We want to hold every residential solar and storage company in Minnesota to the same ethical standards that reputable companies, MNSEIA members already hold themselves to, And we want to create a level playing field where honest businesses compete for consumers based on quality and value in a transparent marketplace. This bill achieves that goal by requiring registration with Commerce, creating standardized disclosure forms, establishing enforceable conduct standards, and it enables, again, a level playing field for all companies in Minnesota. Our members already do many of these things, and we want to ensure that this practice is universal. I'll also address third-party ownership. This bill does not change or expand the current legal status of third-party ownership in Minnesota, but it does recognize that there is some third-party ownership already happening. And what we want to do is ensure that Minnesotans that are entering these complex long-term agreements have a transparent understanding of what they're committing to. Again, Mencia recognizes that our solar and storage market must be regulated and have a competitive standard to realize its full potential. We urge the committee to vote in favor of House File 4880.
Thank you. Next, we have Assistant Commissioner Lisa Polish. Ms. Polish, welcome back. Please reintroduce yourself and proceed.
Chair, Chair Acom, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Lisa Polish, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Federal and State Initiatives at the Minnesota Department of Commerce Division of Energy Resources. Thanks for the opportunity to provide very brief testimony on House File 4880. We wanted to start by acknowledging how much we appreciate all of the work that many stakeholders put into developing this language. The sheer number of hours that parties invested in the process reflects a shared, strong commitment to ensure that consumers are getting what they pay for when they choose to adopt solar and battery storage systems. As we have said many times in this committee over the past 2 years, we will need to have solar of all scales to be able to meet our clean energy goals. Part and parcel of that deployment means fostering the market conditions that facilitate adoption, and that includes strong consumer protection provisions. The Minnesota Department of Commerce oversees more than 40 industries to protect consumer interests and ensure a fair and competitive marketplace in our state. We appreciate that this language has been brought forward for consideration. We note that it identifies many of the key features that should be addressed and outlines a process by which companies and their salespeople can register and transparently demonstrate to Minnesota who is playing by the rules. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next, we have Bart Jackson from Sunrun. Mr. Jackson, welcome to the committee. When you get up there, please introduce yourself and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Distinguished members, my name is Bart Jackson, and I'm a senior manager of policy for the residential solar and storage installer Sunrun. Thank you for your attention to the critical issue of enhancing consumer protections for people in Minnesota. I'm speaking in support of House File 4880. I was grateful for the opportunity to participate in a consumer protection working group with the Department of Commerce, the Attorney General's Office, Chair Acom, and other stakeholders that provided feedback and input on potential consumer protection legislation. Sunrun operates in 22 states across the U.S. and provides home solar and storage to over 1.1 million customers. While we currently do not operate in Minnesota, we work within our trade associations like the Solar Energy Industries Association and Mencia to share industry-leading practices to improve customer experience and protections. Sunrun is supportive of this bill, specifically requiring easy-to-read and understand disclosure forms that include pricing and performance guarantees will help to ensure that customers who receive multiple bids from different installers are able to compare these quotes more easily. This is a good bill. I did want to raise one additional issue for the members of this committee, which is third-party financing, third-party ownership. Sunrun views this as a priority consumer protection issue. Right now in Minnesota, there is some market confusion regarding the ability of consumers to be able to benefit from solar and storage without having to make a large upfront down payment. Third-party financing enables consumers to lease solar panels and a battery, which spreads lease payments over a 20 or 25-year contract with service warranties and performance guarantees. Today in Minnesota, a cap of 25 customers exists per solar installer. Third-party financing is available in at least 35 other states without a customer cap. This is creating confusion in the marketplace on what is allowed or what companies can offer to customers. This fix would bring increased economic development to Minnesota, help enhance consumer protections, and increase access to home solar and storage for lower-income households. In the wake of last summer's HR1 at the federal level, consumer purchased solar is now 30% more expensive than it used to be. Consumers who purchase solar through a lease are still able to access a 30% federal tax credit, however. I thank members of this committee for your time and am available to answer any questions that you may have.
Next, we have Kent Sulem. Please make your way over there and then introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Acomb, Chair Szczesinski, Vice Chair Kraft, thank you very much for giving me some time this afternoon. My name is Ken Sulem, and I'm the Director of Government Relations and Senior Counsel for the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association, MMUA. Although I was signed up to testify in opposition to House Bill 4880, it would be more accurate to say that I'm here to support all but one provision of the bill. However, that provision is so important to our members that we'd rather forego and lose much of the needed consumer protections offered in House Bill 4880 rather than move in a direction the bill takes in terms of statutory recognizing and authorizing third-party sales. We're not talking about leasing, we're talking about sales directly to customers of small municipally operated utilities, an action which is in direct conflict with Minnesota Statutes 216B.40 that sets the exclusive service territory for each utility. Authorizing power purchase agreements is the method by which the camel gets its nose under the tent into the realm of third-party sales. Even though House File 4880 proposes some regulations over solar providers, they still will not be subject to the same type of regulations, obligations, and expectations of the utility whose service territory is being invaded by the third party. The local utility must still provide services needed to make third-party sales work, must still provide services to the remaining customers, must be responsible for maintenance and operating expenses, but with lesser revenues. Remember, at the community level, it is not about profit, rather how to provide reliable, sustainable, and affordable service. This becomes increasingly difficult if third parties are allowed to cherry-pick key customers to maximize the provider's profits. Amending House Bill 4880 so that the consumer protections are imposed to third-party sales directly to utility customers in violation of 216B.40 were to remain prohibited would result in a bill that MMA could likely support. But as it currently sits, we must oppose House Bill 4880. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sulem. With that, we'll turn to member questions and discussions. First, Representative Mekland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, I think, would probably be best suited for Sarah. A couple years ago, we passed where if it was rooftop solar on the primary residence, the solar installer had to be a licensed contractor. Would those entities that have made that adjustment and now become licensed to the state so they can do rooftop solar, would they be required to get these additional licensing?
Ms. Webby.
Chair Kraft, Representative Mekland. As currently written, yes, we are considering an amendment to narrow the registration requirement. The purpose of the registration is to require licensure for entities that sell solar. And what we've learned since the implementation of the contractor's license requirement that you authored is that many companies will go out and sell systems, and they may have a contractor's license. They may not. But they may take the system that they've sold to a consumer and then sell it to a licensed contractor to build. And that creates a gap in accountability where the sales company often might make claims at the time of selling the system that the installer might not be aware of and might not be able to fulfill. So again, I think we are looking at the language of the registration component carefully and looking at modifying it to require only a company that sells solar. It may sell and build solar and then have to get sales licensure, but if it sells solar in any way, we would like it to let me be clearer. We would like it to be registered with Commerce.
Representative Mecklen, follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking for clarification how those two would go together so they're not getting double whammied, if you will, because in that whole, what we did back then, that only applies to the primary residence. So if a sales company said, we'll put it on your outbuilding, that they wouldn't require to be a license at that point. And I actually have a constituent, the third one that went belly up in Minnesota, they had paid for it on their pole barn, and that company didn't make it, and he committed suicide, so it was nothing for them to go back after. And what we did wouldn't have helped them either. And so I was just, as I'm reading through this, I was curious of how you're going to blend the two together. And in our side, of the, when with the our building license number must be on all our bids. Mm-hmm. It must be on anything that we print of any sort, even a sign, which would then hopefully narrow out that. I mean, those are things to take into account. As in, like, because they are already tied into the building code by being licensed now, that it can't be like somebody out selling on a contractor's behalf because they are then representing that contractor. So that's just my thought. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Switzinski.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, this is an interesting bill. You know, it seemed like even when we had testimony about the net metering, it was some confusion even among the testifiers within the solar industry whether or not they sold the tactic of that other customers would essentially pay for their solar installations. And so it's, you know, I saw that you had Sunrun up here. Sounds like they've got their problems even in Massachusetts, like dozens and dozens of lawsuits against them potentially there. You know, we've heard, heard some major issues with misleading tactics, misleading sales tactics. You know, I think that's been our concern all along when it comes to, you know, creating a situation where we have highly profitable government-mandated business, you oftentimes have problems. And, you know, I think, you know, we've had solutions of just getting rid of some of the programs, which would help solve it so that you had good actors, you didn't have mandates. This is one way to go after it as well, is try to clamp down on the sales tactics. It's because it is so lucrative. And it is so expensive for ratepayers to pay for these programs for other ratepayers. So, you know, I think this is one way to go about it, fixing the problem. We can also address this from the other end of things, is get rid of the mandates and get rid of some of the other things on utilities for these products, I think would also help.
Cherry, come response.
Yeah, just I thank Representative or Chair Swazinski for bringing that up, because this bill is really about targeting in on high-pressure sales tactics and, you know, shady actors. So, and I want to say, you know, with what Representative Mecklen brought up, as well as Mr. Solem, I think that clearly the bill is being laid over. So there's will be an opportunity to work on it for more likely next year. So open to conversations. I had also a brief exchange with MREA. So happy to continue conversations. So thank you for the input.
Last comments, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Akam. My concern is really, you know, it kind of goes on a trend. First of all, the salespeople, I literally called on thousands of farmyards with my business. It can be anywhere from a one-person sole proprietor to a bunch bigger. But what's stopping this from being the next business and the next business and the next business? When will it be the customer just saying, you know what, I don't want salespeople at all? So how do you justify when we step in and when we don't with regard to people that are out doing business?
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you bring up an interesting point. I will say that, again, the reason for this bill is to protect those who are consumers that are looking to buy things, and to know and have faith that those people that have been licensed through Minnesota will have been properly vetted, that they're being overseen by the Department of Commerce, and making sure that if anything is not up to par, that it's being documented, and they would be, those salespeople would be penalized. So I think you and I agree on the concern, and I think maybe I don't agree that we shouldn't
have people selling things in our state. I think that we want people to be selling and buying, and that's kind of the whole churn of our economic vitality. But I hear you, and do think that we need to have guardrails to protect the consumer.
Mr. Chair, just small providers, you know, this is a real hurdle for small providers. It's a lot easier for big business. They can do all this stuff, but the small providers, the entrepreneurs, they're the ones that are typically hurt by all these little hoops you have to jump through. So just keep that in mind.
Thank you.
Chair Ekam, any final closing comments?
No, just appreciate the conversation today, and we will more talks to continue.
Great. With that, House File 4880 is laid over. Next, Chair Ekam, you have House File 2862. Do you want to move your bill?
Yes, thank you. Last, but by no means least, we have House File 2862 be laid over, and I do have an author's amendment.
Do you want to move your...
Actually, it's a DE. My apologies. Yes, we would like to move the DE, please, to get the bill in the shape we'd like to consider it.
Okay, Chair Ekam moves the DE1. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The DE1 is adopted. Moving to your bill.
Great. Over the last several years, there's been a lot of attention in the energy sector on data centers, and rightfully so. They have the potential of impacting ratepayers, preventing us from meeting our 100% clean energy goals, and negatively impacting our water and environment. Last session, we made some gains in protecting ratepayers and our clean energy goals, but were unable to pass meaningful environmental protections. This bill renews that conversation. We can all agree... Is that me? I don't know where that beeping was coming from, but I don't think it was me. We can all agree that what business wants and needs to be successful is predictability. To date, the large-scale hypercenters have been relying on Alternative Urban Area-Wide Review, or AUAR, for environmental review. This falls short in many cases because that review was done long before a data center was ever identified to be sited in that location. That means that the environmental impacts of a large water user were not considered. That means the environmental impacts of hundreds of megawatts of diesel backup generators were not considered. It makes sense to have an identified and appropriate environmental review process so that everyone can understand the expectations. This bill is an effort to set those expectations. In short, the bill asks data centers to develop a flexibility report with the Public Utility Commission, demonstrating efforts or opportunities to shift load to other tools to reduce demand during peak energy consumption times. And it establishes an environmental review and permit to ensure appropriate protections and public engagement. And with that, Mr. Chair, we will turn it over. There's a couple of testifiers.
All right. First, we have Amelia Voss. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you so much, Chair Ekam and members of the committee. My name is Amelia Voss, and I am the Climate Program and Energy Program Director at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, or MCEA. MCEA is a nonprofit public interest law firm and advocacy organization with over 50 years of experience protecting Minnesota's environment and the health of its people. I am testifying today in support of the DE1 amendment to House File 2862, establishing environmental review and permitting processes for data centers. Minnesota needs a better plan for data centers. There are at least 10 concrete hyperscale data center proposals in Minnesota right now, and more on the way. MCEA has monitored all these proposals thoroughly and reviewed the information that municipalities and the data center developers have shared with the public about these projects. Here's what we have found. Normally, projects of this size and scale with this level of impacts on community resources would have to do an environmental study called an Environmental Impact Statement, or EIS, before going forward. However, no data center project has done an EIS in Minnesota. Instead, we have seen data centers try to use other methods that haven't worked. Currently, data centers are producing documents that they contend explain impacts of their project to the public. However, these documents do not even include the words data center, instead calling the project a light industrial development. The impact of this practice is that no one knows these documents are discussing a proposed data center until it is too late and the public no longer has the ability to weigh in. These documents also fail to report critical things like the total electricity use and how this will impact the community's utility rates, the total water needs and how this could affect the community's drinking water source, or the plan for the electronic waste and whether it will fill up the local landfill much sooner than expected. Moreover, there is currently no operating permit for a data center in Minnesota. This means there is no governmental entity looking at the project as a whole and assessing whether, based on all of its impacts, it is safe for that specific community. This is not how we do business in Minnesota, and we must demand better. Minnesota does business with honesty and integrity. We are transparent with communities about what a project is and how it will impact them. We give the community an opportunity to share their feedback and have it be meaningful. This is the least we should expect, and that is what this bill does. It creates a fair process that is uniform and ensures the information that needs to be known by the public and decision makers is known before we give our land and resources to a new project. We've given data centers an opportunity to come to the state without a regulatory framework in place, and it hasn't worked. That is why it is time for the legislature to act by adopting this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Sarah Meradian. Please come up to the table, introduce yourself, and proceed.
Thank you, chairs, committee members. My name is Sarah Meradian. I'm the Government Relations and Policy Director for CURE. We're strongly in support of House File 2862 as amended by the DE1 amendment. As Chair Akam said, last year's law does not address environmental considerations or community protections when it comes to hyperscale data centers. That's why our organization and others, including community members, keep showing up. This bill would add clarity, consistency, and efficiency to what is currently an ill-fitting and frustrating process. The AUAR was not designed with hyperscale data centers in mind. It has been inconsistently applied across the state, leading to a distrust of developers, end users, and local governments among the public, and even legal challenges. And projects that undergo an AUAR can still trigger subsequent environmental review, extending the process, not shortening it. By establishing the hyperscale data centers are expected to undergo a consistent, already known form of environmental review from the start, developers and the public will understand what to expect and when, have clear opportunities for engagement, and avoid expensive and time-consuming legal challenges after the fact. This bill is about the responsible analysis of proposed projects that stand to have significant impacts, both good and bad, on your communities, your constituents. It's about making sure non-trade secret information held by developers is shared with the public at the appropriate time and that decision makers can comprehensively evaluate the impacts of the proposed development in full view of the public. These companies, some of the wealthiest in the world, want to use Minnesota's resources, whether that's our land, water, electricity, or workforce, and will enjoy a significant sales tax exemption in the process. This is about accountability and public trust, plain and simple. I also want to note that, like last year, hyperscale data center end users are not choosing to come here and testify on bills that, according to supporters, would impact their ability to operate in Minnesota. If hyperscale data center end users have concerns about these bills, they should be the ones showing up in these committees, not others. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Kathy Johnson. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Kraft and committee members, for allowing me to testify. I'm Kathy Johnson from Farmington, Minnesota, and I am a member of the Coalition for Responsible Data Center Development. While testifying last year for Representative Acomb's bill, Dr. Sidney Lieb from the Department of Commerce was also present, and I distinctly remember her saying that the AUAR, the tool commonly used for environmental review of hyperscale data centers, was never intended for this scale or this magnitude of a project. Yet laws that exist were designed for legacy data centers, minuscule by comparison to hyperscalers, so the tool continues to be allowed. During public hearings in Farmington, many environmental issues were brought to light. The DNR has still not approved the massive water request in the AUAR, for which our city has signed a contract guaranteeing that water from the domestic water supply. There are four endangered species on this site: light pollution, noise pollution, proximity to long-established residential neighborhoods, effects on private wells, nitrous oxide emissions. Many of these concerns were simply written off during public hearings with a statement that they will be dealt with at permitting. That is a reactive approach. After the fact is too late. Citizens need the legislature to protect us and our Minnesota resources from predatory developers who are fleecing Minnesotans for their quality of life by using our resources, our air, our land, our infrastructure, and our tax dollars purely for private enterprise, profiting the wealthiest corporations in human history, and then turning around and asking for the tax exemption in doing so. It's time to look at this and be brutally honest. As Representative McEwen said recently, the project in Farmington makes no sense. Huge magnitude in the midst of residential homes, and it's happening in other places throughout the state. We need protection from the sheer profit motive of big tech. An EIS will slow this process to allow thorough evaluation of both the cost and the benefits to our state outside the influence of the developer's Kool-Aid. If hyperscalers want to come to our state, I ask that you establish a proactive framework, including an EIS. Big tech in Minnesota needs to play by our rules. Please support HF 2862. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Jim Pearson. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Pearson. Please introduce yourself and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jim Pearson with Xcel Energy, and I appreciate the opportunity to share our perspective and also sort of the broad agreement with Co-Chair Akam's statement around data centers. All of us working in the energy space don't get into too many conversations without the issue coming up. And I think there's absolute agreement on the importance of getting the details right. I also want to sort of acknowledge and commend the legislature for getting into this topic. It's complicated, and again, the details matter. The bill that was worked on and the time that we spent last session dealing with the issue, while it may not be perfect, it is bringing results. And I wanted to share a little bit about what we're seeing as a result of the legislation that was passed last year. There is no question that that legislation provides a very constructive framework, and there's no question that utilities like Xcel Energy have heard the concerns at the legislature and are doing everything we can to try to meet the intent of what we are discussing and talking about here in this forum. Today, we are filing with the Public Utilities Commission our electric service agreement that we've negotiated with Google around their project in Pine Island. That is a filing that will start to move forward now that it will be with the commission. And two values that came out of the legislature that are part of that agreement are really what I wanted to highlight today. One is Minnesota is pretty clear on pursuing a clean energy transition. Xcel Energy is committed to that. This project, and again, details matter. This project is enabling new wind resources, about 1,400 megawatts of new wind. It's enabling 200 megawatts of new solar, and it's enabling 300 megawatts of battery storage. The battery storage is the technology that the committee heard about a couple of weeks ago in the Form Battery Project. To give you a sense, Xcel Energy is moving ahead with a pilot project in Becker. It's a 10 megawatt, 100 hour battery. This project is talking about a 300 megawatt, 100 hour battery. So those resources are on the front end of our system. So all of our customers will be benefiting from adding those resources to our system, and the energy or the cost causer, so to speak, Google in this case, is carrying the financial responsibility for those investments. So again, the details matter, and we think we've got an agreement to put forward to our regulators that will be a model for future agreements to come. The second value that I really wanted to draw attention to is its impact on our existing customers. Very critical. I know I've heard it from Chair Akum. I've heard it from Chair Swedinsky. I've heard it from pretty much every legislator I've talked to about the concern on existing customers if this isn't done correctly. So laying out in our filing, we will show that this agreement will bring benefits to our existing customers to the tune of about $75 million a year. That's over the 15-year electric service agreement, over $1 billion in savings. And a lot of that comes from the fact that we have a lot more kilowatt hours to spread fixed costs across. So again, details matter. I fully agree with that. We're proud of the agreement that we're bringing forward to the commission that's being filed today. And I think it's, again, healthy to have this robust conversation, but I also want to commend the legislature. There was a lot of hard work put in last year. This project is sort of the fruits of that labor. And again, we hear the values that we as Minnesotans have and certainly want to do our part to live up to them. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Next, we have Dan McConnell. Please introduce yourself and then proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Dan McConnell. I have the honor of serving as the president of the Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council. And we're here today to support responsible data center development and concerns with House File 2862. We are proud of the work that was done last session. Minnesota passed a data center law that is already becoming a national model. In less than a year, we're seeing local results. Last month, Google announced two projects, which the previous testifier just talked about, that reflect that success, bringing major clean energy investments, hundreds of union jobs, and significant new revenue for local communities, schools, and weatherization programs. That investment is tied to Minnesota's commitment to 100% carbon-free electricity by 2040, which is attracting companies that want to plug into the cleaner grid that we have. We appreciate the intent behind 2862 and the efforts to address questions about grid impacts and community concerns, and believe those questions are valid. However, in its current form, the bill risks undermining the very framework that is working. It would jeopardize billions of investments, thousands of jobs, and critical local revenue. It also sets a concerning precedent by singling out one type of development for an additional costly permitting process, despite the fact that data centers are already currently regulated, particularly for their electric use under current law. These data centers don't have smokestacks. They do not process hazardous chemicals. They do not discharge into our waters. They do not generate heavy truck traffic. In fact, they're one of the lowest impact forms of development a community can consider. They do, however, use a lot of electricity, which is an impact that's already comprehensively regulated by the Public Utility Commission under the 2025 law. Golf courses consume more water, residential subdivisions use more land, hospitals have similar air emissions, and rooftop solar also generates electronic waste. Yet each is subject to local review and attains permits specific to their air, water, and land impacts. We urge the legislature to build on what is working, not disrupt it. We're leading the way on responsible development, and we hope that we'll keep it that way. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Okay, with that, we're going to turn to member discussion briefly. We've got about 3 minutes left. Anyone with 1 minute? Okay. Anyone comments? If not, I will let Chair Akum close her bill. Oh, wait. Did you want to, Representative Mecklen, quickly?
Quickly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we're short on time, I just want to point out that there's a letter in your packet from Becker. I think it's worthy of the read. Chair Akum and I were invited to speak on the MNCEA panel last year for the data centers. I pointed out the fact that we have been the host to a 2,400 megawatt coal facility. I think a data center in Becker would be far more environmentally safe. Thank you.
Chair Akum, to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate all of the comments that were made, and I agree very much with Mr. Pearson from Excel about the Pine Island Google proposal. There's a lot to be really happy about in that, and I agree. And I think it was impacted by the work that we did last year, so I appreciate that. And in terms of the last testifier, Mr. McConnell, I think that one thing, I agree that data centers bring jobs, and what we're seeing with the lack of environmental review, many of these data centers are being challenged in court. And so
these lawsuits are wasting time, and time is money with many of these businesses. And so I think having a predictable and appropriate environmental review can actually be a win-win for industry and for our state to protect the resources and protect our communities. So with that, I renew my motion that the bill be laid over.
Okay, thank you. With that, House File 2862 is laid over, and we are adjourned.